Welcome to episode 4 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Cowley, joined once again this week by friend and local historian, Tim Abbott. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, Brent. Good to be back.
Definitely. As we've noted in past episodes, the concept of this series is to share new information on topics that we've randomly discovered and deemed interesting and then, you know, further explored. And this week is a really neat one for our entire region. We'll be talking about the iron industry and its impact across the towns here in the northwest corner. For those of you who listened to last week's episode, you know that we touched on the iron industry topic via the Sharon Valley Tavern, which was the business office of the Sharon Valley Iron Company. The history of the local iron industry is a big topic, and there are so many remnants all over our region in the present day. And Tim, you and I were talking the other day, and you made a great point about the forest and the impact of the charcoal industry.
Sure. If you look around the northwest corner today, it's hard to imagine it as an industrial landscape. You see these great older forests on the upland slopes of all our mountains. But if you peel those trees away, which you can do either by walking along in the woods with your eyes to certain landforms, or even cooler than that, if you use something called LIDAR, which is laser-indicated direction and ranging, which removes the signature of the trees or of buildings and reveals the contours of the land, it looks like a moonscape. Our hills have the 20-foot diameter circles all over them, linked by faded 18th century and early 19th century what are now woods roads, but were then colliers' paths, because those are clear evidence of the charcoal hearths that dotted this landscape and made that iron industry possible. And it also meant that the trees were cleared primarily to create the fuel for the furnaces.
I'd say it's amazing. And, you know, in certain locations all across here in the northwest corner, you can find the charcoal pits, and they're all about the same size. There's some really great ones in the Miles Sanctuary over on West Cornwall Road. It's a neat pass. The other thing, too, which is really neat is, you know, certain areas they had to get to using trees as well, you know, meaning that they had to make the Corduroy Roy a road through the swamps. So they had to fell the trees and then stack them to make sure that they stabilized the swamps. So it's a really cool pass.
If you look at the three ingredients that were needed for that colonial and early 19th century iron industry, we had all three here. We had the forests for fuel. We had the limestone, which was used to remove impurities from the ore. And we had high-grade iron ore, not bog iron, not the kind of things they had in eastern Massachusetts, but really high-grade iron ore. And that was a reason why this area was contested between various patent holders from various localities. The Livingstons over on the Columbia and Dutchess County side of the line today, their patents conflicted with the Ashleys and the people who settled in northwest Connecticut over things like access to iron. And that was one of the major reasons why the boundaries here were in dispute.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, obviously, they call it the Salisbury iron ore, but it reaches all these different towns, that whatever that vein was. And you're right, the quality was really, really high. And it seems like in the late 1720s, people that are coming through here seem to notice that it exists. And then you see people buying up properties, especially in Salisbury, for the purpose of not to build a house, but to mine that iron ore. What I find interesting is, like, over the course of time, they find that it's highly resistant to shock. So that's why it was so important to make the musket, you know, barrels and the cannons, the cannonballs, and then, you know, much, much later in the future, the railroad car wheels, which is cool.
So we're indebted to our dear friend Ed Kirby for much of what we know about the iron industry here. And those who's here knew him and Sharon, just a prolific researcher and storyteller on these topics, which raises the question, that's new that Ed didn't reveal before. And I think it's the understanding about how these past land uses inform the landscape of today. They were important in their day. But as we were discussing earlier, our regrown forests are probably in their third growth, first being from clearing for charcoal, the second being pasture, largely for sheep in the uplands. And then after the Civil War, when the industry changed, when anthracite coal rather than charcoal was fueling the Industrial Revolution, when the deposits in the upper Midwest were more important than what we're here, we shifted to this uplands of grazing land. And then when we went from wool to milk, right? We don't put cows on the top of the hill, and the trees grew back there first. So those 90 to 120-year-old forests that we now look at as if they are, you know, bucolic wilderness are the expression of 200 years of engagement with that landscape of our forebears.
Yeah, but and also pretty much the perfection of the blast furnace locally, because you know we had the first in what we now know as Lakeville, but that became known as Furnace Village. And I think a lot of it tied into, like you said, we had the lime, we had the charcoal, we had the iron ore, but we also had the stones, the sands, and the clays that created the blast furnace, you know, in terms of a perfect unit. And a guy by the name of Isaac Bartram later on improved that. But the first blast furnace in our area was right there in Lakeville, and that was the group that Ethan Allen bought into. He was at that, he used to be in Cornwall, then he moved up to Salisbury. And then he partnered with two brothers, Samuel and Elijah Forbes, and then a merchant from up in Massachusetts, Colonel John Hazleton. So that was the first blast furnace in the northwest corner. And obviously, Allen would later sell his shares in the company, move on to new ventures. But I think that's important for people to understand, because I think that's something that we came to know in our research.
Not only were they pioneers in creating that hot, highly efficient smelting process with the blast furnaces here, but they also took advantage of water power, which is the other key ingredient. In order to get the iron ore as hot as it needed to be to melt, required huge amounts of power, and that's coming from our mountainsides and our energy streams, which is why you see the forges located right next to fast-moving brooks, streams, and small rivers. The Blackberry River, for example, Weebatuck Creek, Furnace Brook. How many places do we know with that name? Right, they're all linked to this technology. And then the other thing that you alluded to earlier was the importance of this resource during the American Revolution. Again, there's secret technologies that were brought to bear here. Actually, industrial knowledge of how to make cannons, how to forge and cast iron cannons, and that had to come from England. It was such an important tech, many things that the British restricted the colonists from being able to produce. They wanted us to make raw materials and ship them to the metropolis and then receive finished goods. And they did that in lots of different ways prior to our independence struggle. But this was an absolutely essential ingredient, because in addition to needing gunpowder and flints and clothing and willing people, we needed artillery. And Salisbury provided an enormous amount of it, almost 900 guns that we can track, ranging in size from 1-pound swivels to coastal artillery. A lot of it went to ships. A lot of it's probably in the bottom of the Penobscot River, having sunk in the transports that went with that ill-fated expedition in 1779. But some of it was at the Battle of Saratoga. Some of it was down defending New York in 1776. A lot of it was along the coast. And there is an example, though we don't know for sure whether it came from Salisbury or not, of an American cast of that kind that was secured about 10 years ago by the Salisbury Association and is on display.
Yeah, people can see it. That's the neat thing, too. But the other thing that kind of, we've always heard, growing up, I always heard about the arsenal of the revolution, and it's come to light that we really were, and that's through, a lot of work from a lot of people and the research. Some of it comes from orders with, at the time, Jonathan Trumbull, ordering committees of safety to come up to Salisbury soon after the outbreaks occur in the Boston area. And I found that interesting because apparently at that moment in time, the individual that was running the furnaces was an English merchant, or
that's right.
He was here, but he was providing to the English, and obviously had leanings towards being a loyalist, which made sense at that time period, because if he's making good money with England, why would he want to break with England? But he, luckily, is in England, so we're able to overtake the operations there in Lakeville. And from that moment forward, they bring Samuel Forbes back. I believe he was in East Canaan. And then he comes into play with the cannon manufacturer. And from what I've read, it seems as if he was very experimental, and he was very good about testing each and everything that he made. Like, for instance, with the cannons, I believe they were cast in the ground.
Yes.
And then when they were cast, using the water from the factory brook, which, comes down from the Grove if you're a local, and the pond at Bauer Park, and they would drill, basically, the barrel bores and through the water power from the factory pond. And then they take them up the hill to the present location of St. Mary's Church, and they'd fire them into the hill beyond Community Field. Now, if they fired incorrectly, too high, too low, left, right, they'd be tagged, and then they would rebore them to correct those issues, which I found to be fascinating.
You have to proof artillery if you want to rely on it. And this continued all the way to the last guns that were cast in our area during the Civil War down in Amesville by Adelbert Ames. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
Who in addition to having a huge factory producing at that time railroad car wheels, he also made the largest artillery pieces of the Civil War. They were never used. They were so big, they arrived too late to be in place anywhere where they could do good service, but he did test fire them in Falls Village, and there are accounts of massive cannonballs found on hillsides. So what you have to do if you're trying to have reliable munitions. And that was the thing. They nationalized during the Revolution these vital industries. They posted, as you indicated, to guard it. They had actually a militia officer who was responsible for it, and they exempted the men who worked at the furnace from other military service because they were so essential to the war effort.
Yeah, no, I grew up in the Danbury area, and soon after the attack of the British on the Danbury depots, that was in 1777, we get a group of, 40 or 50 musketeers to come up here in Salisbury to protect the cannon factory and its workers. That's how important this operation was. I'm not sure many people know that, but it's a really neat history for locals to better understand. The town of Salisbury and the Salisbury Association have done a great job with signage. To the right of now the restaurant called The Fern, there is a nice history marker there where you can read all about this history, which I think is great.
If you think about the resource of the colonial era and early federal period iron industry, you're right that it stretches through the entire region. Got going a little later in parts of Massachusetts, but from West Stockbridge down along the Hudson Highlands and into northern New Jersey, it's that same sort of special sauce, right, of the right bedrock or the right forest resources and the right technology. And that was it. I mean, that's when we think of, the Rust Belt. This was our Rust Belt in that period of time. And then it went through an agricultural transition and now into sort of a rewilding.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I think for anyone that just wants proof of that, go to your town's blue sign. Every town has a blue sign, talks about its history. Well, every single one here in our region either has much of it on the topic of iron and all the ingredients, or it at least touches base on it. I mean, Salisbury, Canaan, North Canaan, Sharon, Cornwall, all those signs come to mind, and I think that's a nice capture of the past that the town's invested in, you know, decades ago.
And if you happen to be taking a walk in the woods and are many publicly accessible open spaces, and it's an upland slope and it's near water, keep your eye peeled for level places, possibly built up on the downhill slope a little bit, that look somewhat circular. If you put your finger into the leaf litter, within half an inch, you're going to find charcoal.
Definitely. All right. Tim, once again, greatly enjoyed this conversation, and you'll be back.
You bet.
All the listeners out there, we've provided stories at robinhoodradio.com. Touch base with us. Let us know what you like, what you want to know more about, and we'll make future episodes based on that knowledge. In the next episode, I will very likely be flying solo, but it's a topic that I know well, and I'm sure you will enjoy it. It's Mark Twain and all the things that I've learned about him over the course of my 25 years of research. What's even better is that episode will be recorded on his birthday, November 30th, and that's 113 years after his death. He still remains relevant, and that's for a reason, and I'll tell you why. So until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Take care.
Old Stories, New Information, hosted by Brett Colley, is produced at the facilities of WHDD, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.